All right, so let me start with a quick outline of what I'll cover today, and if I don't do too badly, maybe I'll get a chance later on in the program. I'm going to describe work on defect motion in mesophases, primarily topological defect motion. So I'll very quickly tell you what topological defects one can have in two kinds of mesophases, smectic or lamellar, and hexagonal or columnar faces. It's just a quick review. Then I'll also very quickly review how we can set up a long wavelength description of defect motion. How does that one do it mathematically? Then I will primarily focus today on grain boundaries, and I'll tell you why, although I'll keep the rest, but I'll mostly talk about grain boundaries. And I'll tell you two things. One is the consequences of grain boundary motion on domain coarsening. That is, this would be a snapshot of a three-dimensional lamellar structure. It consists of locally ordered regions in which the lamella point in arbitrary directions. And the question is how this structure coarsens as a function of time, how the long-range order is achieved. And I will look at the aspect of that that involves the motion of topological defects, how these order domains that you can pick with your eye actually grow because of the motion of defects. And that will be domain coarsening. And then I'll also tell you a little bit about defect pinning. These locations, these connections, grain boundaries that I'll describe can themselves pin, and that impedes coarsening. I'll describe how that happens very generically, and I'll focus on the two cases I promised at the beginning. One is the lamellar or the smectic phase, and I'll also show you results for the columnar or hexagonal phase, both. This is work done by a postdoc, Dennis Boyer. And let me list just very general questions just to frame the rest. I'm going to look at the longest possible relaxation of a macroscopically disordered structure, and typically you would expect that that's controlled by the longest lived modes, and typically those are topological defects. So I'm not going to be looking at a chain relaxation. I'm not going to be looking at those scales. I'm going to be looking at a very, very large scale and how the topological defects rearrange themselves and move at those scales, just because one expects that that motion is what controls the slowest possible relaxation of the state. So the thing to do, of course, is to study the interaction of defects and their collective motion. And as I said, I will focus on mainly grain boundaries, but I'll describe also motion of dislocations and disclinations to some extent. And I'm going to do that in the context of a structure which is macroscopically disordered, that is, you have lots of grains. For the same reason that I'm looking at very long timescales, one looks at a long wave description of defect motion and coarsening, meaning that I'm not going to worry about the defect core. I don't really know much about the physics of the defect core, and that is typically ignored. So the defect core for us will be just a topological singularity of some field. And I will look at how that topological singularity actually affects the far field structure. This is more general than block copolymers, but in a block copolymer, that means that I'm going to only be looking at diffusive relaxation of monomer concentration. So think in terms of the Leibler free energy or the Brzozowski equation. But I don't know much about chain dynamics, so I'm going to switch gears from the talks of yesterday and Tuesday. Hopefully I'll learn enough that I'll be able to put that in too, but not yet. Also, that's a technicality in some context, but the models I will be describing today are such that the evolution is governed by a minimization of a free energy. And some of the things I've done break that, but I am not going to discuss this today. So the type of motion I'm going to present to you is driven by free energy minimization, period. And that's generally true whenever you're sufficiently close to a threshold of instability or the ODT in this case. So for a block copolymer, that unfortunately also means to you today that there's no flow whatsoever. So I'm not going to be shearing any sample, and I'm not going to be looking at flow. I've done a few things with flow, but I will not describe them today, maybe later on in the program. All right, so a smectic phase, as I will be using it today, is one that has a broken translational symmetry in only one direction. So it could be a lamellar phase like this. So you do have a solid-like structure, a periodicity in one direction, but in the two transverse directions you have a fluid. There's no order whatsoever. That's, I will call that a smectic phase. It's a lamellar phase, a stripe phase. It has lots of names. Three defects that one can talk about there more, but one is a dislocation. So if you now look from the side, and these are the lines of constant density or constant order parameter, if you go around a circuit sufficiently far from the defect, since there's an extra line, the integral over the circuit doesn't close. It gives you an extra piece, which is the Burgers vector. This is an edge dislocation. It's the same thing as in solids. So as you go around a closed circuit, there is an extra piece that needs to be added because of the singularity. There's an extra row. That's a well-known dislocation. Another type of defect is a disclination, in which what you're doing is you're inducing a rotation of the one-dimensional lattice. So these are lines, now the same as those. And you have this extra line that terminates here. And what this does is just, if you look at the orientation at the normal of these lines, the order, the wave number, or the normal to these lines, if you integrate in a contour around this defect, what you will find is there's a net rotation by pi. It's a line of discontinuity. This is technically a plus 1/2 disclination. This is a minus 1/2. As you go around the defect, you rotate by minus pi. This is another type of defect that appears generally in smectic phases. And then there's a grain boundary, which is a boundary where two domains of different orientation meet. So this is a lamellar phase oriented in this direction, a lamellar phase oriented in that direction, and this is a grain boundary. If the grain boundary is of sufficiently low angle, the angle between the two domains, then you can think of it as a collection of equally spaced dislocations. But anyway, these are three types of defects in a smectic phase. Of course, if you have a macroscopic configuration, you have a soup of them, and this is just a snapshot of a configuration. So I've highlighted a dislocation for you, sorry, a disclination, and you see how the lamella necessarily are bent around them, and there's nothing that these poor lamella can do to stretch themselves out, even though they would like to be straight, and they cannot because of that singularity. So that actually forces the structure to be curved. This is a dislocation up there, and then I also highlighted two grain boundaries. These fellows see each other, they interact, and they move as the system is trying to evolve towards equilibrium. So columnar phase now has a broken translational symmetry in two directions, not just one as the smectic, but two. So you have a fluid-like or disordered structure, say in the z direction, but then you have a broken translational symmetry on the plane. And let's assume it's a hexagonal phase in that direction or on that plane. So this is akin to a two-dimensional crystal. It actually is something more like a crystal than a smectic phase. It only has a broken translational symmetry in one direction. And I've shown you examples of the three defects I gave before. These are now disclinations. If you look at the red dot, that guy has only five neighbors as opposed to six, as everybody else. And this has seven. And those are the ones that actually induce this curvature of the hexagonal lattice. People that do nonlinear dynamics often call them penta and hepta defects. They don't care much that they're disclinations, but those are disclinations of a hexagonal lattice. I showed here a dislocation. A dislocation ends up being a pair or a bound pair of those two disclinations, or a penta-hepta defect. And the way, well, let's see. This is an order parameter, so think of a density representation across the horizontal plane of that picture, and the white dots are just meant to represent the hexagonal lattice. So if it's white, it's a point which has a local coordination number of 6, it's locally hexagonal. If it's a cross, this fellow only has 5 neighbors, so this is a penta defect. And if you have a cross, that fellow has 7 neighbors, so it's a hepta defect. And a bound pair of penta-hepta defects happens to be a dislocation of a hexagonal lattice. I've also drawn those lines because dislocations in hexagonal lattice have the following property. You can think of the hexagonal lattice as a superposition of three plane waves at 120 degrees. And at a dislocation, two of the three amplitudes of those three waves vanish, but not the third. So I drew lines, red, blue, and green, to help you see that. So if you look at the red line, it goes continuously through the dislocation. So that particular component of the three waves is completely unaffected by the defect. But if you look at the blue, you'll see there's a familiar dislocation of blues. And also, if you look at the green, you'll see a dislocation of the green. So dislocation in a hexagonal lattice, which is a bound pair of disclinations, also leads to the vanishing of two of the amplitude, the three amplitudes that can be used to compose a hexagonal pattern. So that's a dislocation. And then you also have a grain boundary. And a grain boundary is the boundary in which two domains of different orientation, and you probably can see it better from far than I can see from here, the two domains are oriented differently, and again, it's the same color coding that I've used here. You'll see just pairs, sometimes not so close, but pairs of pentahepta defects. This is without noise, there's no temperature, so at zero temperature, they like to be bound. And the line of these locations now is a grain boundary.
Could you comment on the motion of that penta-hepta pair in light of the different directions, the green, red, and blue? Is it more free to travel along, say, that red
right.
trajectory?
Yes. Right. You can do the analysis the same way you would do for this location, but keeping track of three amplitudes. Yes. And anyway, just to show you a picture of a macroscopic phase, although it's hard to make much of it, but a big chunk of a hexagonal phase would look like this. You would have oriented grains separated by grain boundaries all over the place. It's hexagonal. I'm not going to get into the hexatic business. All right.
You can have hexatic phase.
Yes. Yeah. Right. But for the purposes of the systems that we study, fluctuations are too small to worry about them. So I'm just going to ignore that altogether. Well, sort of. All right, so let's start a little bit with the math, the main thoughts. I'll present some numerical and some analytical results. All the numerical results are based on this equation. This is the Brazowski model or the Swift-Hohenberg model, or it can be also derived from the Leibler free energy, if you wish. And the numerical results that I'll show are based on that equation. The reason for doing that is because this equation actually has solutions that display both symmetries, the smectic and the crystalline symmetry. In the case of the polymer, you have to think of it, as you know, of the other parameter psi, as the imbalance in monomer density between the two blocks. In space, I'm sorry. The analytic, I'll come to the analytic in a minute. The field psi is it's a real function. And this equation has a number or a small quantity, epsilon. This epsilon is, in the case of a polymer, the reduced distance to the order-disorder transition. So when epsilon is negative, you would be in the disorder phase. When epsilon is positive, this equation gives you periodic solutions. The order solutions, because of this particular combination of derivatives, k0 squared plus the Laplacian square, the solutions, the stationary solutions that this equation has when epsilon is positive are actually periodic. The solutions are of periodicity k0, this parameter that you put here. So these are two things to bring to your attention. I've listed quickly what the stationary solutions are. So if you make this term G2 zero, the quadratic term zero, for epsilon less than zero, the only stable stationary solution is psi equals zero. That is a disorder phase. If epsilon is positive, then psi to lowest order in epsilon is a sinusoidal function of position with wave vector k0. The wave number is, of course, the same one that you've put in the equation, but the orientation is degenerate, so you can have this periodic solution in any orientation. So you do have a synectic phase because it only has periodicity in one direction, but the orientation of this wave is arbitrary. This is the familiar circle that you get in scattering experiments above the, when you have a disordered sample, it's just a ring around Q0. If this coefficient G2 is not zero, then for a region of epsilons, the stationary stable solution is actually a linear combination of waves such that it gives you a hexagonal, a pattern of hexagonal symmetry, and this is the crystalline phase. So at least in terms of the numerical calculations, by tuning the parameter G2, you can go from one to the other, and the numerical results I will show you are actually based on numerical integrations of that equation. Now, Now that equation is only a model, and although you can rationalize it in a number of contexts, in the present one through Leibler's free energy, it has a bit more generality in the following sense. If you consider slowly varying modulations of that stationary solution, so now think that I'm not in a steady state where the system is perfectly periodic, but the system is perhaps in a transient, so that the field psi is the basic periodicity modulated by an amplitude. In the case in which this amplitude changes slowly in space and time, so you have weak modulations, then the amplitude satisfies the so-called Ginzburg-Landau equation. And the generality of the analysis comes because this is the equation that you will get at any supercritical bifurcation as long as you keep yourself to weak modulation. So for any supercritical or second-order phase transition, if you look at weak modulations of the base periodic solution at some k0, this equation describes that modulation, so it's universal in that sense. You find this for block copolymers, you would find this for fluids, and a variety of systems. The only memory that the system retains of its original physical system is k0, the periodicity, and that will result from some competing interactions in your physical system that will determine k0. A characteristic time scale, which is a diffusive time scale in this particular case, and a length scale, a sort of correlation length that measures the rigidity of the pattern to long wavelength distortions. So those are the three parameters that remain from the original system. And of course, the number epsilon, which is the distance to your bifurcation. So the analytic calculations I'm going to be describing today are actually generalizations of this equation. So I will be playing in the numerical case with the equation I gave you before, and then in the analytic calculations, I'll be playing with generalizations of these sort of equations.
In neither case are any kind of fluctuation effects
taken? I will have fluctuations later, yes. I'll add fluctuations in the context of pinning, and I'll describe some results for that. Now, typically, people have not worked out fluctuations because the energy scales that are typically involved are much larger than thermal scales. So fluctuations are typically thought to be irrelevant in the context in which people derive those equations, which are fluids.
But certainly not in the block.
Correct.
We know that the
correct.
And theoretically.
Correct. And I'll do some fluctuations too, but let me qualify how much I believe the weight fluctuations are put in when we get there. But I'll do some of that. I'll do that. Alrighty. So the first description of effect motion in this particular context that I know of was done by Eric Sige and Zipelius in 1981. And they actually looked at the equation of motion of a dislocation. So the way you do that is the order parameter psi still contains too much information about the defect to make it tractable. So the description uses the same decomposition in a modulation A and a periodicity, a periodic wave of wave vector K. And then they look for solutions in which the amplitude A decompose in its real part and a face, the solution was such that the face had a singularity. So as you do an integration over a closed contour of the gradient of the face, then you find that you get 2 pi plus or minus 2 pi. So you can find solutions for this of the previous equation of this form that satisfy that the phase is singular. The moment that you go to a description like this, you're looking at a long wavelength modulation of the periodic pattern, so you're just looking at point singularities of the amplitude field. So the topological defect now is just a point, and you satisfy this condition. The phase theta just tells you where in space the line of constant order parameter is located, so it plays a role of a displacement field if you want to think in terms of a solid. Once you do this, you find that this defect is not stationary. It actually moves with a certain velocity, and the prediction that they made is that the dislocation climbs with a velocity which depends on the wave number of the structure minus the critical wave number, the k0 in the equation, to the power of 3/2.
So can you explain that a little bit? Normally, if you put in a point defect, you would put in something which has this singularity of that type.
Right.
But I don't understand the role of the additional modulation vector k. So what you're saying is you have a modulation on top of the lamellar, the basic lamellar structure, with a wave vector which is in principle different from the k0 prescribed by the structure. Is that right?
Yeah. So you have the modulation,
right?
And then the pattern is not perfectly sinusoidal. You will have a modulation, right? And that particular amplitude of the modulation will happen to have a singularity at that point. Now, the reason why k is not k0 is that for this particular equation, you have to have the lamella under a little bit of compression for the dislocation to move.
So
far away from infinity, the pattern is a little bit under compression. The pattern cannot be under extension because it so happens that this particular equation has a zigzag instability when k is more than k0, so you don't consider that. But k is a periodic, is the modulation, but it's slightly larger than k0. The disclination has also been done recently, but I'll show you the results if you're interested. It's fairly similar. I'm going to look at the grain boundary because, at least from numerical calculations, it seems that coarsening is mostly controlled by the motion of grain boundaries. But I don't have a firm proof of that, but you'll be able to judge later. So a grain boundary now needs 2 amplitudes. So you're sort of looking now from the side. Here you would have a lamella oriented in that direction, and here you would have a lamella coming this way. And this would be the grain boundary. So A and B are now the slowly varying envelopes of the grain boundaries, the right one and the left one. Actually, maybe this will help. So think of this as the grain boundary, right? Seeing from above. So you would have the modulation of the field as you approach the boundary, and then it goes to 0, and then eventually it will go to a constant as you go in that direction. For this particular case, you can also derive a set of 2 coupled Ginzburg-Landau equations for the 2 amplitudes, A and B, that are coupled. And something that's interesting now that will come up later again is that the extent of the transition region, the extent of the boundary proper, scales as lambda 0, which is 2 pi over k0, times epsilon to the minus 1/2. So the extent of the defect becomes larger and larger as you approach the bifurcation point or the order disorder transition in a way that it's 1 over the square root of epsilon. And as you go further away from threshold, the extent of the defect becomes narrower. So you look at how the boundary moves, and the easiest thing to do first is to study how it relaxes if you perturb it. If the grain boundary, if there is a stationary solution that corresponds to a flat grain boundary, you can have a B domain adjacent to an A domain. If both of them have a periodicity of 2 pi over k0, that grain boundary is known to be stationary. and the profile is known. So what I'm going to show you now is how the grain boundary relaxes if you distort it. So you impose a long wavelength modulation on it, and you let it evolve. One thing happens which was expected, and one thing happens which is not quite expected. The first one is that it relaxes back to its stationary position. If the flat grain boundary is stable, then you think it's going to the perturbation is going to decay. And there is a decay rate. The perturbation decays exponentially with a rate that's proportional to k2, to the perturbation to the fourth. What is not so obvious is that the grain boundary also translates. So not only relaxes, but in fact the position moves. And it moves to the right. It doesn't move to the left. And that actually happens to be a mode that depends non-linearly on dx, where dx is the initial perturbation. So it's a linear relaxation mode, but there's also a motion of the grain boundary. And I can briefly tell you why it moves in one way and not the other. The two phases are not really, the two phases are of course equivalent, because the two phases are of the same wave number. But the two phases are not symmetrically located with respect to the grain boundary. One is parallel and the other one is perpendicular. And the elasticity that's implied in the equation in the free energy is not the same for perpendicular and parallel distortions. So, for example, phase A only pays a penalty when you distort along the y direction of the fourth derivative, whereas phase B would pay a penalty of the second derivative. In physical terms, what that means is that it's easier to distort the lamella transversely than it is to do longitudinally. That's known. So for a given epsilon, you're going to distort one phase more than the other. And therefore, as a consequence, you will have an excess energy in one side with respect to the other. And minimization of free energy just leads to the translation of the grain boundary. So the unequal elasticity of the two phases actually causes the motion in one direction on top of the relaxation. That velocity can be calculated analytically, and it scales like the curvature square, the curvature now of the lines of constant order parameter, or the curvature of the grain boundary. And it has this singular dependence on epsilon. So this effect actually becomes more and more pronounced as you approach the threshold, as you make epsilon zero. Yeah.
I'm wondering if another way to express that would be that if the boundary relaxes, that straightens the lamellae on the right, and so then they would be under tension, so the boundary moves to compensate. Is that true?
What you actually see is that one invades the other, so it's not as it straightens out, no.
So there's a mass transfer from
one phase to the other. I don't think there's much mass transport.
Well, there's a conservation of mass, so how are you going to have a boundary without mass transportation?
Well, you also have mass here with the same density, right? Oh. Both phases have the same density. They're both periodic, right? So there isn't.
Right. So you have some part of material used with phase B. A that becomes phase B later. Right?
But the two phases are identical. They're just one rotated with respect to the other.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So there's no long-range mass transfer. There's some local rearrangement, but nothing diffuses far away because you just have all the mass that you need locally. You just
sure. So the basically polymer somehow
phase B eats phase A.
Yeah, they rearrange, they rotate if you wish.
But is your phase A under tension on the dilation or not?
No, it's not. It's only
under compression.
It's only transversely modulated.
Yeah, but if you keep this period constant, then when you do this, you are effectively putting compression in the layer.
A little bit, right. A little bit. A little bit, but it's very small because this Q is very small. Is this?
But you were saying initially they are at the same K0.
That's
so
right.
If you straighten one, then you have to.
This is in the limit of vanishing Q, right? So yes, you do it a little bit. You push them a little bit closer, but it's vanishingly small compared to K0.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm very confused about this. I mean, you're saying that this grain boundary translates uniformly. That is, a certain time later, the picture just looks as if it's been slid to the right, without a change in the amplitude of that little wiggle.
No, no, the wiggle decays.
The
motion is complicated, and I can show it to you. The motion has a mixture of the relaxation, but the relaxation takes place around an average. No. I'm sorry. There is a relaxation, and the relaxation is around an average position, which is not fixed, as you would expect. The relaxation is around an average position that moves.
Okay.
But this motion is also complicated because as the distortion decreases, the motion of the average also decreases, so eventually it vanishes and stops.
Right, so does right. It move about as far as the amplitude of the wiggle before the whole thing's done?
It can move actually pretty large distances. You can make it move a lot or you can make it move a little, depending on epsilon. But it eventually stops. You can integrate the equation and it gives you a total distance travel. It doesn't.
So is it correct to say it moves about as far as the sort of interface thickness?
Here, I have it. Okay. So, this is the total distance travel, d infinity, with respect to the wavelength. And it can be as much as you want it, as you make epsilon sufficiently small. Now, there's a limit to all this because at least the analytic calculation is based on delta x0 being sufficiently small. You don't want to perturb them too much. There's a limit to the perturbation in terms of the wavelength, the wavelength that you can achieve. So, but making epsilon sufficiently small, you can make it travel as much as you want.
As much as you want, but still the upper limit is something of order 1 over root epsilon?
It will be of the order of 1 over square root of epsilon.
It's something like it's the same as the size of the heating region.
Right.
So that's good.
Okay. And the relaxation rate, how did that depend on epsilon?
The relaxation rate, I think, is proportional to epsilon. But I'm not sure. I'll check. There's. You mean at the constant of proportionality?
So we actually found more than proportional.
I don't remember that. I'll check. I have to check. I don't want to say something silly. Sorry, you had a comment, Ed? No. Okay. All right. So anyway, as is the case with dislocations and disclinations, this can also be written as a time-dependent driving force divided by a mobility. And generically, mobilities end up involving integrals of gradients of A0s, B0s, where A0s and B0s now are the base solution for the undistorted grain boundary. Now, what I really want to use this for is to study coarsening. So let me show you a movie. This is now a numerical calculation based on the order parameter model. And it's in a range of parameters in which you form a lamellar phase. But this is a transient evolution starting from a completely random initial condition. Maybe I'll stop it several times. But all right, so what you see, there are disclinations. You will also see these locations. In fact, okay, this dislocation glides. You'll see it in a minute if you pay attention. And you also see grain boundaries. So anyway, if you look first here, you'll see that dislocation. Actually, let me go backwards. Maybe. It already did its thing. Sorry, I'll restart it. Yeah, it's okay. Okay, so where is it? Here. Just disappeared. This is in two dimensions, yes. Okay, you also see grain boundaries moving. So this is one here. There are others. But you see the motion in which one advances towards the other. And you also will see that these clinations typically don't move much. They just sit wherever they are. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to try to rationalize some results on the coarsening of that structure that you saw in light of the equation of motion for a grain boundary that I derived, plus a little bit of hand waving. I just summarize in one page a few things on domain coarsening for those of you that may not be familiar. In many cases, one observes that coarsening can be characterized by a single length scale, an average domain size, for example, so that every length that remains in the problem actually becomes proportional to this characteristic length scale. There is a single length scale, which is time dependent, and scaling behaviors observe in that every quantity that has dimensions of length is just proportional to that characteristic length R, which you can then relate to the domain size. The argument that's typically made is that as time goes to infinity, the domain size grows indefinitely because the structure is coarsening, and therefore all other length scales become irrelevant, and that's just an argument borrowed from critical phenomena in which the correlation length plays the role of the domain size. To describe coarsening, it is customary to introduce scaling functions. So for example, if you would think of, say, a probability distribution of domain sizes, so you go over a configuration as a function of size, you do a histogram of the domain size at some particular time, then this probability distribution function could be written in a scaling form that would involve R divided by our characteristic length scale that typically satisfies a power law in time, so it grows as t to the x. And for many years, people have used this description to then characterize various systems in terms of the value of the exponent x. And then, by analogy with critical phenomena, you state that systems that have the same value of x belong to the same so-called universality class. Many systems have been studied in the literature, of course, and I just listed a few of the known values. Systems that purely evolve to minimize their free energy and eventually lead to a completely uniform phase tend to have exponents x of 1/2. Systems that relax to minimize their free energy to a uniform state, but the relaxation has to satisfy some conservation law, conservation of mass, for example. So you are not free to rearrange your mass, you have to diffuse it somewhere else, and that requires perhaps long-range transport, they tend to coarsen more slowly, so the exponent x is 1/3. If you have a fluid in which you have something else beyond free energy motion, you have free energy minimization, you have convection, then this is believed to be faster, and x is about 1. And I think that the motion for smectic phases satisfies x equals 1/3, but I think that's...
So that statement about 1/3 is based on numerical studies, or is your numerical studies or some general arguments?
I'm going to show you the numerical studies and some arguments, because a number of people have looked at this, including myself, and come up with different answers over time. So I'll tell you what the various options are, so you...
Can I ask a question about the movie?
Yeah.
I got the impression that the grain boundaries that were perfectly straight just stood still and didn't do much of anything, and the ones that had some curvature were doing all the moving. Is that my...
No, you're absolutely right, because As long as this is, the grain boundary would be proportional to its curvature. So if it's flat, that it would remain flat. And to the extent that it's curved, it will move.
Is it the curvature of the boundary or the curvature of the phase on one side of it?
Technically, it's the curvature on one side of it, because the structure of the grain boundary is actually fairly complicated.
Do the lamellae tend to follow the grain boundary?
They do, yeah, they do. The location of the grain boundary proper actually is 90 degrees out of, it's out of phase with this one. And it's a little tricky. It's a little tricky to define because, I'll just may as well tell you, the solution for A decays exponentially away from the boundary, but the solution for B actually goes to zero at a finite distance. They're not symmetric. And you cannot obtain the solution completely analytically. It has to be done asymptotically. So it makes sense to define as position of the grain boundary where this guy goes to zero, but this guy goes to zero at some length inside this phase. It so happens that both have the same wave number, but they're out of phase. But the result that's shown here really applies to the curvature of the lines of constant order parameters, you said. So you see the wiggle of the lamella.
Sorry, one more question about that history. Sorry. Here you imposed a distortion on the entire A region, is that right?
That is
what
correct.
What happens if instead you designate that the interface has wandered and then let it equilibrate with that constraint, which means the bulk will have a wandering which decays. If you've got an interface that wanders on a length scale L here, then the bulk, it will decay the bulk on length scale L squared over the layer spacing and start out that way. That's sort of a more natural starting condition than to impose a wandering distortion on the entire bulk of phase A, right? Does that make a big difference, or is it important to do the same?
You can only do the if the calculation is complicated enough if you have far field uniform conditions. That's how you typically study defect motion, right? You have a dislocation, you impose a distortion here, something there, and then the defect moves. The response is going to be different if you would allow what you say. And it will be a combination of this until what the relaxation catches up to the boundary, and then it'll slow down, and it's going to be more complicated. I don't know.
The reason I was asking is that in a typical picture after a quench, you're not going to have bulk uniform distortion.
Absolutely not.
To some extent, the bulk will relax under that constraint. That would be a
Absolutely, and you will have other defects somewhere else, yes.
Did this equation made under the assumption that the interface is bigger or smaller compared to the space?
The interface, meaning this?
You have this overlap of the waves.
No, there's no assumption. This is really solving these two equations.
Right. My question is how the red and green.
It is part of the solution. It's not assumed. This scaling that I'm showing you comes out of the solution. It's not an assumption.
Right. So lambda naught is a period.
Lambda naught is 2 pi divided by k0. That's a parameter in the equation. Epsilon has to be very small for this to be valid. This can only be done analytically for very slowly modulated distortions. Epsilon has to be small. There's a multiscale expansion that you do in epsilon. And epsilon needs to be very, very small.
Okay. So that means the two phases overlap over many periods.
Correct.
Which is like the extreme stations.
The correlation length.
Right, and it's much bigger than the period.
Because it's near the one before the transition.
Right. I'll show you later what happens as epsilon is not too small. But the analytic calculation can only be done in the limit of epsilon small.
Right? I want to ask the question I asked earlier again, and maybe a little more sharply. Can you go one slide forward to the picture of the. Yeah. As somebody said a minute ago, that distortion, the little sinusoidal wiggle that's to the right of the interface that's sinusoidally wiggled by assumption, you would expect to damp out in a lowest free energy configuration for this thing in any given snapshot, would damp out into something which just get uniform spacing over here.
Correct. Okay? That is right.
Now,
right.
If I look at that and I say, why should that move sideways? Well, if it moves by uniform translation sideways, then
then the free energy of the thing is the same because it translates, and so there's no driving force for it to move. Whereas if you have that wiggle artificially extending all the way to the right forever, well, then the free energy on the right is actually a little higher than on the left, and
that's
right.
There's
a bulk driving force for the interface to move. Are you sure that that's not what is making the interface move in your calculation? Since for simplicity, you assume that the thing was modulated on the right all the way to positive x equals infinity.
You're absolutely right that the fact that it's modulated to the right makes it move to the right. You're right. The argument you could, and we've done it, you can do a more general perturbation. You wiggle the right and you wiggle the left. But as you go through the calculation, what you see is that the wiggle to the left is irrelevant at the order in which the wiggle to the right comes in into the equation. Right, so think of an expansion. You have this parameter epsilon, which keeps track.
I'm not suggesting that you should wiggle it to the left. Only the wiggling to the right only extends the penetration length
into
the layers, in which case now the bulk driving force for moving the interface to the right disappears, and it's not so obvious that it's going to move.
Oh, no, that's absolutely correct. But that's how you make a defect move, right? Think of the case of a dislocation. If your lattice far away is completely relaxed, then the dislocation will stop climbing. The only way you can calculate the climb velocity is if you compress the lattice. Right, and it's artificial in some respect. I understand that. But that's how you compute the velocity of the defect. You have to make it move.
So your point is actually that in a general configuration, you will have regions in quench and produce a configuration. You will have regions in varying degrees of distortion, and therefore the interface will move. You're not going to have one interface.
The real configuration is going to be more complicated, right. and it will decay to something which is unstressed. I fully realize that. Yes, you're right. Yeah. Am I answering, Scott?
Well, it just begs a further question, but I'm not going to ask it. You get in the way of what you want to say.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about the scaling exponent here, and to what extent does this one-third have to do with the symmetric nature of the phase? So you list the relaxation dynamics and consider the order frame. Now, what is the final verdict on multigrain, say, POTS model?
Oh, the POTS model, the final verdict, I think, is one-half.
How about conservative?
I think the final verdict is one-third, but... You said the final verdict,
yeah, yeah.
Not according to me.
That's pretty much everybody here.
I think
third is, was for a long time. Third is a very slow crossover, and you've got to get to domains which are 200. If you take an IC model and do conserved dynamics, even two dimensions, you need hundreds of domains across, hundreds of spins across the domain to get to the one-third regime. So people did that 10, 12 years ago by now, now done it. And all of the non-conserved dynamics, our early work in POTS models suggested some exponent less than a half, but that turned out to be a crossover effect as well. So by now, it's pretty standard because now it's easy to go through big systems for long times and stuff. So the first two statements are unambiguous.
Okay. And then would the conserved order parameter just depend on what the volume fractions of the two phases
are? No. Not the exponent, no. Okay, so the way we rationalize the one-third, but this is not a proof. I'll show you numerical evidence, but anyway, I'll tell you my thinking, but it could be incorrect in a few weeks, months, years, I don't know. Now, what seems to happen if you stare at these configurations long enough is that most of the motion takes place through grain boundaries. And this grain boundary is actually moved in a background which is typically curved. And these curved lamella were used earlier as the focus of the study because people thought, well, let's study the relaxation of curved lamella and use that relaxation rate as an excuse to infer the growth exponent. But if you look at them, these lamella don't really relax. They are held in place by a certain distribution of these clinations. So if you look at your system, you have a characteristic spacing between these clinations, call it R, that determines the characteristic curvature of the lamella, and that curvature will be fixed as long as the disclinations don't move. Of course, the disclinations will also be moving slowly, but I'll get to that in a minute. So if you think about the declinations at distance r apart, then you have lamella that on average are curved by 1 over r. And since you have grain boundaries that whenever they sense curvature, they move, and they move with a rate which is proportional to the curvature that they sense square, dimensionally, there's nothing more profound than dimensional analysis, that would give you a coarsening law of t to the 1/3. Just move this, you have three lengths and one time. So this would give you a coarsening rate of 1/3. The question that I think to me needs to be solved is what happens to the declinations, and we haven't closed the loop. I don't think the declinations have a chance to move much, because as grain boundaries move, they actually sweep the declinations away. So the declinations are actually eliminating by grain boundaries as they move, and that you see empirically. And the loop that we still have to close is, of course, that the grain boundaries eliminate declinations.
This might be an appropriate time to mention the Chaikin group experiments, in which, first of all, they don't see domain walls that look like that, basically at all. And second of all, they do see the declinations move and annihilate and interpret the coarsening in terms of that process. Now, I don't know whether there's something about the formulation of this model or the parameters you choose to put you in some different universality class, but at least bears mentioning that there are those experiments.
Right.
And with the they are one thin one. Films of
block
of polymer.
I'm going to go to
snapshots by
an AFM. Yeah, and not only them, there's another set of experiments in electroconvection, and I'll get to that later. But everybody that I know that has looked at this particular set of equations does see configurations like this, and they see the grain boundaries. Now, why the experiments do not see grain boundaries, I don't know. I've talked to them, and I don't know that they know.
Well, there's one person anyway who's looked at these equations, or something similar, but not exactly the same as you wrote down, which is Daniel Vega, who's in that group,
right.
And he does not see configurations that look like this, and he sees coarsening that goes like t to the quarter, not t to the 1/3, with configurations that are consistent with what they see in the experiment, namely dominated by declinations with no visible grain boundaries, which begs the question, what can you do to make the grain boundaries appear or disappear by fiddling around the model? But I don't have an answer to that.
Okay. I don't either. I'll come back to that in a minute. Yes?
The grain boundary velocity assumed that there was infinite domain, the perturbation of the interface was infinite, but then you say that you're talking about, you're applying to domains which have finite size, so wouldn't that affect the scaling itself?
Yes, absolutely, yes. Now, this is supposed to be asymptotic, and I suppose to be it's supposed to be in the limit in which these scales are sufficiently long, right? They are not in this particular plot.
In your simulation, R's are compared
and they're
to
not.
The size.
No, and then you get into the issue of crossovers, where the simulations have reached asymptotic regimes. There's a whole host of questions that you can raise. And I am not trying to suggest that this is the ultimate solution. I'm trying to understand or rationalize numerical evidence, which I'll show in a minute. In terms of an exponent, this doesn't prove anything. The calculation I showed you before is control. I can, if epsilon is sufficiently small and this is blah, blah, I can justify the results. This is not, this is just a, and of course, as you say, this could be very well an intermediate transient. It could very well be that, as Scott is trying to suggest, maybe at sufficiently long times all the grain boundaries have disappeared and all you're left with is just a bunch of declinations that move around slowly, but slowly in the scale I've looked, but not slowly enough for the scale of the experiment. It's of course a possibility. I don't see how, if you have a sufficiently large sample in which you have a rotational degeneracy, you're not going to have large domains in any orientation that meet the grain boundaries. But that's a separate issue.
Do you know offhand the difference between this equation and the one that
I talked to him at the APS meeting, and we didn't look at the equation. I'm under the impression that they have the same one, but they are adding fluctuations to it. And let me get back to this in a minute. Yes. Well, this is just evidence for the 1/3, but let me go quickly. There's a number of measures that you can look, and people have used many. I just chose one. I plotted, we calculated many, and just showed the result for one as an illustration. The probability distribution of curvatures, so you look at the system locally, it's lamellar, you look at the local curvature, you calculate the histogram of curvatures, and then the scaling assumption would lead you to this particular form of the distribution of curvatures with an exponent now z is the same as x as before. If this is the case, then you can calculate moments of various orders of this probability distribution function, the curvature to some power, and if you normalize them properly by 1 over n, they all have dimensions of length, so they all should have the same growth law with time, and here you have various moments in various combinations. They all have the same slope, and the slope is very close to 1/3, at least numerically. Now, maybe I'll jump to this because it's probably an appropriate time. There's been a whole host of exponents given for this particular system over time, and I just listed 4, presumably all of them with the same type of equations, and I'll get back to that, but there have been a number of suggestions for 1/4, starting with us many years ago, and I think that's what the experiments by Chaikin and also experiments by Michael Denin in electroconvection are showing. And I'll get back to it in a moment once I discuss pinning, if I ever get there. But I think that the case is far from closed. I didn't mean to give that impression if I did. Okay, the second thing and last, well, the hexagonal phases, of course. Let me try to summarize the main elements, perhaps. What happens, however, is that this idealized description of defect motion in which you just distort the lattice and compute the velocity, be it dislocations, disclinations of grain boundaries, only holds very close to threshold. And this is meant to be illustrated by this figure. So what I'm plotting is the total distance traveled by a grain boundary as a function of its initial distortion, both made dimensionless by the wavelength. The dots are calculated numerically, and the lines are an analytic calculation based on the formula I gave you before, and there are no adjustable parameters. This is just a straight calculation. If you look at epsilon 0.04, you will see that the analytic calculation basically predicts the total distance travel that we compute numerically, and eventually deviates as you get to larger and larger distortions. So by the time the amplitude is half the wavelength, the calculation breaks down, at least quantitatively. But what happens, and there's a mistake here, this is 0.1, not 0.01, just 0.1. What happens if you increase epsilon is that the boundary doesn't move continuously anymore, it just spins. So for sufficiently small distortion, the boundary just doesn't move, it remains, the average position doesn't move, the boundary still relaxes, but it doesn't advance on average. If you increase the distortion a little bit, then it advances by half the lamellar periodicity. Then it travels by 1/2, 2, and it travels in discrete units. So what happens, at least empirically, is that as you increase epsilon, although it's not too big, just 0.1, this defect is not moving continuously, even though there's the same driving force. It just gets stuck at particular positions in the lamella. At least at particular values of the phase of the lamella. This follows from a so-called adiabatic effect, non-adiabatic effect, and it can be described as follows. And I'll spend some time on this because probably that's the important part, and I'll try to summarize the rest. In the limit of epsilon going to zero, the extent of the defect is much larger than the wavelength. So the defect basically sees an integrated average of the wavelength that it decreases going to zero. But as you make epsilon smaller and smaller, there begins to be a variation of the envelope in the scale of the wavelength. So now the amplitude of the defect envelope actually changes in a scale which is not much larger than the periodicity itself. So if you redo the analysis and you try to account for what are the leading corrections due to this effect on top of this velocity that I described before, remember that before the phase of the lamella does not appear. It is the lamella themselves disappear. All you get is an equation of motion for a defect that depends on its curvature, but it doesn't care whether the lamella is here or displaced relative to the defect. So if you redo the analysis trying to keep that, what you find is that the velocity of the grain boundary depends on its curvature square, but it also includes a term which is periodic in the position of the grain boundary. That is, there is a force, this is an overdamped limit, an overdamped system, there is a force that depends periodically on the location of the grain boundary, and it has twice the wave number. So there's two positions per period where this function has a minimum. And too bad he went, but we've also done the calculation adding noise to the initial equation, the Rozovsky equation. And this is the complete equation for the grain boundary they obtain. There is the same push due to the curvature. There is a periodic potential of amplitude P. And then if you add fluctuations, there's also fluctuation force. The important part is that the spinning potential, P, goes to zero as epsilon goes to zero. So as you go to the ODT, the former limit, long wave limit, holds, and this quantity disappears. It disappears exponentially in 1 over the square root of epsilon. So it does go to zero. However, because of the exponential behavior, if epsilon is not too small, then this potential becomes significant. And if it does, what you have is a grain boundary that would move when it's curved, but will also sense a potential, a periodic potential to its advancement, which necessarily will lead to some degree of pinning, depending on the amplitude. And we've added fluctuations, because once you start thinking about pinning, then you ask yourself about the effect of the fluctuations. And I will skip the details, but just to tell you that the effective amplitude of the fluctuations that are left in the equation for the grain boundary is inversely proportional to the extent, now the lateral extent of the grain boundary. So what you expect when you have some sort of pinning are various, the first is that the grain boundary will have now potential minima, and the decoupling between the defect motion and the underlying lamellar phase is lost. So the first thing that you'll see is that the moderate pinning that you will have, and the amount of pinning will depend on the height of these barriers and also fluctuations if you have them, then the coarsening will be somewhat slowed down by the defect now not being able to advance freely, but just getting pinned once in a while whenever its curvature falls below the threshold needed to overcome this barrier. So the anticipation is that we'll get effective coarsening exponents unless epsilon is sufficiently small that this effect vanishes. The expectation always also will be that if you add fluctuations, then you'll easily overcome these pinning barriers, so you will see changes of exponent when you add fluctuations. Now, I'm mentioning this because this is something that's typically surprising in the field of coarsening for the non-conserve and conserve and Potts model and so on. The scaling exponents have always been observed to be independent of noise. They're independent of random fluctuations. However, in this particular case of a smectic phase, traditionally everybody that's looked at them, the exponents seem to increase when you add thermal noise to the equation. And that has remained somewhat of a difficulty. But if you have this slight pinning that I just introduced, you will naturally expect that the effective exponents that you will observe will be increased. And by how much will depend now on how small or how large your epsilon is, your distance to threshold, and how much the fluctuations that you choose for your particular simulation. And also the final consequence is that if you choose epsilon sufficiently large, and it doesn't have to be large, as I'll show you in a minute, you will find glassy states. Effectively, always you'll find glassy states, because as the system coarsens, the characteristic curvature will always be asymptotically sufficiently small to make the spinning effects come in and stop growth. So these glassy states have nothing to do now with the underlying polymer. This just has to do with the fact that these defects are going to move in a periodic potential. As the curvature of the lamella around defects falls within a certain range, then the spinning effects take over, and you'll see pinning and what something that looks like a glass.
Do you have a picture that shows, let's see. When you're moving, it looked to me as if the domain wall was pretty sharply defined, as if this epsilon was actually rather big. In other words, the very last layer right next to the domain wall didn't seem to show much influence of it except the overall shape, and then bang, you were right into to lines that were ending. If I looked at that, I would have thought that that looked like a pretty big epsilon, that if I looked at what the picture would look like at a smaller epsilon, that these lines would be kind of mushy, and there'd be some white stuff in between there and so forth. Do you have a picture that sort of shows qualitatively what the domain wall looks like for different epsilon?
I don't have the picture. We looked at that. The epsilons that I showed here is 0.04 and 0.1, and the scale of the boundary is going to be lambda 0 divided by the square root of that, right? So if it were 0.01, which is not, it would be 10 times the wavelength. And that we've checked. It does check. This is color-coded and all kinds of things, so it's masked. But we have checked that. I don't have the pictures with me. In the simulation, it was 0.04. What I'm saying is if it were 0.01, a little smaller, the algebra is easy, right? The square root of 0.01 is 0.1, so 1 divided by 0.1 is 10. So if it were 0.1, it would be 10 times the wavelength. With 0.04, it's going to be about 5 times the wavelength.
The pictures, the movie you actually showed us corresponded to which epsilon?
0.04.
So 5 times the wavelength.
Yes.
But I didn't see any perturbations extended out from that thing 5 times anything.
Well, it's hard to...
That, for instance.
Right.
So can well, you okay, but the distortions that move away from the,
I understand the point perfectly.
I see a little bumpy business right in the very first line, right next to it, and then after
right
that
here.
I can't tell.
Right. So maybe I'll show you another. Right. The bumpy business is what you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the bumpy business is what's left over of the other face.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it doesn't look like it goes anything like more than a wavelength.
Well,
right.
Well, it depends on the color. If you color positive black,
here you see a few little drops hanging off, maybe.
It must depend on how you grayscale.
I have another movie, but it's. I have a movie that just has an isolated grain boundary, and I'll show you or everybody at the end. But then I'm not going to finish. We've checked that.
I believe you. I just was.
No, it's a good. I will show you the movie. Yes, absolutely. I don't have one picture. I have to restart the movie. It's going to take a little bit. But. Okay, I wanted to summarize this. I wasn't going to show this, but I thought, based on what I saw on Tuesday, there's been a number of people that have looked at that, and typically what people see, and let me start at the bottom maybe, is that the exponent is small, 1/5 with no noise, typically going to 1/4 with noise. And that has been seen by Christensen and Alan Bray, Nigel Goldenfeld and his group. Cross and Mayron did that too without noise. They were looking at non-variational effects and they also got 1/5. And we also did that many years ago and we saw the same thing, 1/5 to 1/4. There are two sets of experiments. That I know of. One are done by the Chaikin and Rick Registers group, and they do see 1/4. The mechanism that they use to interpret the quarter is discrimination annihilation, and as Scott says, they do not see any grain boundaries in their samples, and we just don't know why that is. And the other system is electroconvection in a nematic. It's a fairly complicated problem, but anyway, the exponents also seem to see 1/4. So experimentally, there's nobody that has seen 1/3. At least that's a statement I should make at this stage. Now, the trouble is that we can reproduce all those and more just by changing epsilon and the amplitude of fluctuation. So the one thing we see, and to summarize this picture that perhaps has too many plots, is that if we go to sufficiently low epsilon, we see 1/3, and the 1/3 is independent of fluctuations. So if we add noise to a small epsilon system, it continues coarsening at the same rate as you would expect. If the system has no pinning. By increasing epsilon, not too much, so there's 0.15 and 0.4, we can get 1/4. You can get even things that go slowly, more slowly than that. So we've gone to the coarse trouble of repeating this for parameter values of other calculations, and we do get things that look 1/3, 1/4, 1/5, and then it slows down if you go to sufficiently long times, and so on. So you can reproduce the zoology of exponents that are observed. We also get pinning and glassy configuration. Sorry, we also get a glassy state, and I don't think we're the first to see them, even in numerical calculations, except that perhaps other people put them in inside in their paper. But this is a configuration show for epsilon 0.5, and it's a snapshot, but the system just stops here. It never evolves anymore. It just stops. There are no fluctuations in this case. And the calculation that I gave you before of the pinning potential allows us to compute what is the scale that the system will reach before it actually stops growing. What is the configuration? What is the characteristic domain size before you reach a glassy state? And it depends on epsilon in this particular form. Of course, you can turn on fluctuations, and then the system unpins. So if this is a configuration which has been generated without fluctuations, if you turn on thermal fluctuations, it will continue coarsening, but eventually it also stops. And the argument goes as follows. This is an order of magnitude type of estimate. It assumes that the only effect of the fluctuations on the interface will be their motion over the barrier. I'm not looking at, one could think of broadening of the interface, and one could worry about roughening, but I'm not going to look at that at the moment. I'm just going to tell you that if I take the equation for the grain boundary, which we derived before, this one, and you turn this into just a one-dimensional equation of motion for the grain boundary position, then it looks as velocity has a systematic term which tries to reduce the curvature. It has this periodic pinning potential, and it has a random term which has this particular amplitude, where now this is the extent of the grain boundary. So what this actually turns out to be is just the escape over a barrier. This is a systematic force that helps you escape the barrier. This is the amplitude of the barrier, and this is the amplitude of the fluctuations. So the escape rate is just simply written as the exponential of the various constants in the equation. And of course, the grain boundary would unpin when this rate would be, say, of order 1. And that gives you the intensity of the noise or the intensity of the fluctuations that would be needed to unpin a structure that has a particular scale. Or you can turn this around, of course, and if you give me the value of epsilon and the amplitude of the fluctuations, I can tell you that the system will not pin until a certain scale. Of course, the scale will be larger than in the absence of fluctuations, but eventually the systematic force is also going to be sufficiently small that not even it, aided by fluctuations, will be able to overcome the pinning. So eventually it would cross over to something that might be logarithmic in time or extremely slow. But this way you can calculate the scale of the structure as it pins as a function of the intensity of the fluctuations and the value of epsilon.
Is it right to treat that as a 1D problem? I might have thought that the way it's to blip over a short distance. I'm thinking of a line going from one well to the next.
Right.
That you might have a nucleus, a critical nucleus side for the jump in the other directions.
That is correct. That I have not done. No. That's what I meant by the interface could actually broaden, which would mean that it would have all these flips. So effectively, the noise would just broaden it as it moves. Yeah. So this is just an order of magnitude, but I don't think it's too bad for that.
The only difference is that the barrier is to be proportional to the length of the line, proportional to greatly decreased, right?
The barrier has to be inversely proportional to the length of the line. Yeah, I think that's all right. All right, so the last point I want to make, and I'll quit in a couple minutes, is now what happens if you have a hexagonal face? Remember, a hexagonal face is one that has a broken symmetry in two directions, so it's a 2D crystal. And here you have a grain boundary separating two domains that have a different orientation. We've done the same calculation about the motion of the grain boundary, and we find I shortened the equation, but it has the same structure, velocity, a pinning potential that depends on the misorientation angle of the boundary So it's maybe a little hard to see, but you can understand what the misorientation angle of the two domains is. And we can also compute the amplitude of the pinning potential. It has exactly the same form as a Pyrrhus force, except that this one we've derived it's an approximate analytic derivation, but within the validity of the multiscale expansion, this is an analytic result, which tells us that the amplitude of the pinning force depends on the misorientation angle theta, and it also depends on xi being the thickness of the boundary, as before. However, the hexagonal case is slightly different because for a lamellar phase, the thickness of the defect, or the thickness of the boundary, scales as 1 over the square root of epsilon, which leads, as I described earlier, to an exponential term that involves 1 over the square root of epsilon. However, for a hexagonal phase, the thickness of the defect is always finite. It doesn't diverge. And it doesn't diverge because in this particular case, the bifurcation to the hexagonal phase is subcritical. It's first order. So that thickness actually never diverges. It just becomes finite. And in fact, you can calculate its value, which is inversely proportional to the coefficient G2, which is the coefficient of the quadratic term in the original equation. Remember, when this coefficient goes to 0 is when you have a lamellar phase. So the main qualitative difference between the hexagonal and lamellar phase is that this spinning potential cannot be made 0 just by going arbitrarily close to threshold. It just will remain finite.
Which regular move now? Up or down?
I don't know.
Is there like a symmetry?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. This is flat. There's no distortion. So I would have to.
If it's a bisector of the two directions, how do you break the symmetry for a great boundary?
He's talking about the periodic pinning potential.
I haven't looked at the distortion, and then I haven't. No, it doesn't move. This stays put.
And if you distort it was still there. It would move.
If you distort it, it will move, but it's going to be a complicated soup because now you have 6 amplitudes. So we haven't sorted through that yet.
So this quantity you just got by asking how the energy will change depending on where you place the boundary.
That's right. Where the boundary is placed relative to the phase of the right. So this is done numerically. You create a grain boundary and you try to compute numerically this spinning force. For the lamellar phase, it does go to 0 as you decrease epsilon. But for the hexagonal phase, it just asymptotes to a particular value, which depends on the coefficient G2. I also should warn you that these calculations are only strictly valid when G2 is small. Right? You cannot be If the bifurcation is strongly subcritical, the amplitude equation formalism itself also breaks down. So you have to keep also sufficiently close to you could call it a weakly first order if you wish. So these values will be themselves also small. But they asymptote to a finite value. They don't go to 0. And finally, I think I'll just stop here. We can derive, which I just showed you, the dependence of the pinning force on the misorientation angle of the boundary, and we find something that's very reminiscent of what happens in a metal in true materials, which is that the pinning is very small at high angle or at zero angle, and if you think of the inverse as a mobility, then large angle grain boundaries have high mobilities and likewise. However, the pinning potential increases for small angles, so the lowest mobility grain boundaries are the low angle grain boundaries. The lines are 3 analytic expressions for 3 values of G, and the dots is a numerical calculation for 1 of them. So the green line should coincide with the red line. There's no fitting parameters, right? So if everything were right, this would be coinciding with the red the qualitative behavior is reproduced, but quantitatively itself. I think that what's structurally imprecise at this stage is the numerical calculation, because it's hard to just put a grain boundary and let it relax in a small size system. But anyway, so I'd like to summarize that in the limit of epsilon going to zero, we think that the microstructure coarsens with an exponent of 1/3 independent of fluctuations. But I need to remind you that this is in disagreement with other people's calculations before. And it's also not currently you would obtain from experiments. At small but finite epsilon, we believe that the motion has corrections due to the fact that the defects see the face of the lamellar or hexagonal face as they move. And this can lead to corrections and pinning. And it's our way to rationalize effective coarsening exponents that have been observed and have been observed to depend on the amount of fluctuations. But we also think that this can lead to glassy behavior. All this is, I don't think the qualitative picture is incorrect, but there are lots of caveats that one has to mention. For example, the expansion I have given you is technically valid for a small epsilon. And I'm just telling you that eventually the pinning will be such that you will have glassy states. But you could legitimately question the validity of the results when epsilon is 0.5 or larger. Right, so I think the qualitative trend is probably correct, but whether we are picking up the dominant effects or not, I cannot guarantee to you. I'm reasonably sure that at a subcritical bifurcation, pinning effects cannot be avoided, although they could be small, but they will not be zero, because the extent of the defect will never be much larger than the periodicity of the base lamellar phase. And under the conditions that I just stated, we can actually calculate what is a Pyle's force for defect motion analytically. And in particular, that gives us the law of motion as a function of the misorientation of the boundary, which happens to be what people observe in solids. So I think I'll just stop here.
Question related to Scott's question. What is the difference between a configuration with just a bunch of dislocated disclinations
Yes. And
one actually with grain boundaries? Because if you draw a network of grain boundaries, then the nodes of that network are disclinations, right? So what's the, is it just that it's in one case the grain boundaries are so smeared out we don't call them grain boundaries? I don't understand the formal distinction that in the discussion between you and
Scott. Well, you have the domains that just meet, but they never meet at an angle. So they just meet and you have...
Like this, you're saying, sort of gets curves in like this instead of actually colliding lines.
I actually have a picture. I don't know if I'll find it. Okay, this is an AFM image from their experiment. And the two dots are 2 - 1/2 disclinations and 2 + 1/2 disclinations caught in the act of annihilating simultaneously. So that's how the configurations look like. This is, I believe, a columnar phase where the cylinders are lying on their side. So even though you see stripes, it's supposed
to
be...
It would have been, actually, yes. I think that's not quite right. It would have been in the bulk of the lamellar phase, and they have prepared the thin film in such a way that you would end up getting stripes. Their hexagonal phase films are made from cylindrical phase, which likewise they prepared in such a way that it's orthogonal to them.
Okay.
So this in bulk would be lamellar?
Yes.
But I don't see why this is at odds with yours at all, because they're just in a different time regime. You showed that the grain boundaries move fast. They're in a regime where the grain boundaries are enormous, and they're looking at the next fastest thing.
That's one possibility, but in the calculations I've seen, the declinations are eliminated by grain boundaries as they move. So if you would have a crossover to a humongous time where all that's left is a few declinations, could be, I don't know.
This picture, Ralph, is not really representative in the sense that I've chosen a small subregion of an extremely large aspect ratio thing to show an elementary process that they're
right.
claiming is,
right.
is what's going on. The actual pictures look like fingerprints of very large people, if you see what I mean. If your thumb had an area, 10 to 100 times bigger than your thumb, then the picture that you would see would be a thumbprint.
But with no grain boundary?
No.
But I will say in this man's defense that if you look at a TEM image of a lamellar block copolymer phase, it really has grain boundaries, and there are a few defects of other types in the grains.
Right.
Is this 2D or 3D?
This is a film.
Right. And are you talking about film or are you talking about
pulp? Slice.
No, I'm talking about a slice of a three-dimensional.
Right.
How come in the line, there are tilt boundaries where the lamellae just are continuous and just the boundary conditions have forced them to meet it?
Right.
And as opposed to grain boundaries where something with the order parameter actually goes
right.
away. Can you tell us anything about the relative frequency of those two? In these coarsening simulations, do you ever see tilt boundaries, or do you always have a real high angle?
In the simulations, we always have.
That's real life. But there's a tilt boundary right there.
Yeah, that's true. That's exactly what. In fact, that's all you can see here.
Off to the left.
In the simulations, you don't see many of those because this particular model. It has to do with the isotropy of the derivative, the fourth order derivative to give you the isotropic ring. That term is the term that controls, that term has the special derivatives. So that term controls the energy penalty that you pay when you have defects, right? Derivatives of the amplitude. And because of the symmetry, it's such that the lowest energy is the one that has 90 degrees. It's the same reason why these guys, if you have a solid boundary, they orient themselves perpendicular to the solid boundary, not parallel. So if you have them generated spontaneously, you will have a propensity of those in this particular model, which may not be what happens in the experiment.
Further, if I go deeper into the lamellar phase, further from the transition, then presumably it may be described by some sort of symmetric hydrodynamics. That is, I can't see that how that feature is going to survive in a more.
That's absolutely right. This is just the lowest order, which is isotropic. But yes, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
In 2D semantics, there will always be a finite domain size. So once you add solenoid. So I wonder whether that's saying the same thing as your opinion picture, because if you put noise, it will stop at the correlation length, which is anisotropic.
I think I'm saying something similar. Yes. Yes. The system will saturate to a finite size.
Right, at thermal equilibrium. That's the equilibrium prediction.
Oh, no, no, no.
There is a.
Well, the equilibrium, no, the equilibrium state is a uniform state.
No, we worked out the theory as to how the grain size would scale. It's not infinite.
A two-dimensional symmetric at thermal equilibrium is always unstable to the
right.
direction of
exactly.
free, of unbound dislocation. But that may, I mean, the scale for that may be so big that, you know,
it could be, but I'm trying to remind myself what you did. But it's finite; it's not infinite.
Right. I'm calling this smectic in the sense that it has a one-dimensional broken symmetry. This is not a smectic, and for this particular model, the free energy has a minimum, and the minimum is a uniform state.
But that's ignoring some noise.
But Zhengang, I mean, that is sufficient to screw up the registry of the layers, but not sufficient to screw up what amounts to the monadic order. The layers can be well aligned and the phase registry messed up because of this, the dislocations.
Right, you still
have. That's not really what your eye is sensitive to in these pictures. When you say they're well aligned, if you look a little closer, you can see that they're still full of dislocation.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask another question?
No, they don't destroy the symmetric order.
The visible domain structure has to do with the orientational order.
That's right.
The destruction of translational order is evident in those pictures. There's lots and lots of little forks. But that doesn't modify the overall orientedness of it.
Right.
So, you know, you can play, so.
Overall, you mean infinite, that there's one director?
Yeah, that's orientational order. Orientation. Well, I mean, let's not worry about quasi long range. Okay, orientational order also is weakly modified by fluctuations, but that's an even finer effect. The point is that if you ignore that, symmetric translational order at finite temperature in two dimensions has only a finite range. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But orientational order, nematic-like, okay, the fact that the lamellae will be parallel, not necessarily in step, but parallel, is almost not destroyed entirely. I mean, if you really want to be fussy about it, that also becomes power law like. But that's it.
Just Scott, just briefly, I wanted to show you this, where you may see a little better the.
Yeah, there I can see all kinds of
dots
that I thought I might see.
Right. And here you'll see it disappear, I think. Yeah, but
that most intrinsic is an attraction of the two walls, right?
It is not an attraction, right? If this particular system is sufficiently small that there is a small attraction, you have to go to a very large.
Right.
Yeah, we've checked that, right? They see each other.
So one possible explanation of the relationship between what you did and the experiments, which you said is it could be. The hang effects are giving a larger epsilon are giving something different than what you get a very small epsilon. But the thing that's bothering me about that explanation is that the pinning effects would slow down the motion of the domain walls
and
slow down the process by which you wiped all the domain walls out of the system.
Right. There are two sets of experiments. Actually, there are three. I think Nitaj Balsara looked at this several years ago. But he did find different growths in different directions, and he took an average, and then he gave an exponent of the average. But I'm not sure what that means. The experiments in liquid crystals give one quarter. But if you look at the plots, I think you could, there's plots that go like this, and then they go like this, and somewhere in the middle there's a one quarter. The ones that Paul Chagin has are pretty clean. They're pretty much a power law. The only thing I can think of is that as you pointed to, is the fact that the real equation should be anisotropic. If you have an isotropic Liouville free energy, then the resulting Ginzburg-Landau equation is anisotropic. So you'll have preferential orientations like this or some angle, but this is the one that has lowest free energy. If you add an isotropy to the original equation, then the Ginzburg-Landau equation becomes isotropic, so it loses this preferential 90-degree energetics. So it is possible, I don't know, I haven't tried, it is possible that if you tweak an isotropy, then you will make grain boundaries not so favorable, and then the dominant mechanism will have to be something else. If it's going to be that in this particular equation, I don't know. But the appearance of the grain boundaries that I know is directly tied to the isotropy of the kernel of the derivatives.
So when you say anisotropy there, you mean that is that you'll have different derivatives normal, different coefs, second derivatives normal to and parallel to the local layering.
Right.
Can you do that without introducing a director field into your description? I would think the natural way to do it would be to introduce the director field. So write something like a Duchenne model.
Yeah, it can be done, sure.
Nonlinear terms in which gradients of the order parameter.
Yeah, but that's awful. We'll have mod grad psi downstairs and things.
Well, well, absolutely. It means you have non-local, non-linear terms.
Right, right.
Okay, makes sense.
Yep.